Senate Committee on Finance and Revenue. So here's how I see things for this morning, if for timing. We have first Senate Bill 38, and we're just going to get clarity on a legislative council issue on that, and we'll do that from until 9 o'clock. From 9 till 10, we will do Senate Bill 518, and at 10, we will do, and hopefully right at 10, we will do Senate Bill 69. So for those of you who are waiting for Senate Bill 69, that will come right at, on the nose, 10 o'clock. Open a work session on Senate Bill 38. We'll have the good Harrison Conley come up and talk to us first about the issue that arose, I think, yesterday relating to relating clauses.
Good morning, Chair Deckert members. Not the kind of thing that I want to come talk to you about, but after drafting several amendments on this, we looked up and realized that we were rushing a little bit too fast and moving too far forward. The relating clause on that is relating to recordation fees. And in the process, we're creating a new fee and sending the money to housing. It's fine for us to say what we're doing with that money as a matter properly connected therewith, but we're making some additional changes relating to the way some of those accounts work. And so basically what we need to do is come back to you with a priority draft as quickly as we can. It has a better relating clause to get done the things that it sounds like there's a lot of agreement to achieve with this bill. We will work with the folks who are, it sounds like it's not my place to say, but I believe Senator Carter is prepared to work with a lot of the folks who are having concerns with the draft and try to pull all of that into one piece with an appropriate relating clause.
Okay, so the question that we've had yesterday, that'll take some time, is can you do one amendment with this relating clause? You have several issues out there from one that Senator Morse is going to talk to us about mining claims, another obviously in terms of the percentage. Can those all fit under the relating clause in Senate Bill 38, or does there need to be a whole new bill on Senate Bill 38 with a broader relating clause?
Let's see, you mentioned the mining claim. The mining claim is probably a matter properly connected with the fee, so we can do that.
And the amendment that Senator Carter's been working on with some of the advocates of this bill, is that an amendment that we could draft and fit into the relating clause on Senate Bill 38?
I believe that is an amendment that does not necessarily fit within the relating clause.
Okay, well, that would mean a new bill. Questions for Mr. Conley?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Since we have the fine representative legislative council sitting before us, the question that I think that remains unanswered in my mind, though I might be in the minority in this, in fact, I'm likely in the minority in this, is we are raising a fee in this bill. And I would argue that it's a tax because it's not related to, especially some of these fees are not related to housing whatsoever. And whether or not constitutionally the Senate can start a bill that raises taxes, the definition between fee and tax I think is one that's shaded as it relates to this bill. But I would argue that this bill ought to start as a House bill. Per the Oregon Constitution.
Chair Deckert, Senator Starr, could I ask for a bit of clarification? You suggested that wasn't related to housing.
The Oregon Constitution requires tax measures to begin in the House of Representatives. This bill, in my estimation, is a tax increase, tax measure. It's not a user fee that we kind of generally look at fees. When you raise a fee, that's generally has a nexus to its to the purpose for which you're raising the fee. This fee that this bill contemplates raising and how the fee will be appropriated has very little nexus to the payor of the fee, especially when you look at the potential of individuals that are getting a death certificate for their spouse in order to handle the issues of that are circled around that. I don't see a nexus at all with that fee going to affordable housing as this bill contemplates. So from my perspective, what we're talking about is raising a tax, and tax measures constitutionally are required to begin in the House of Representatives.
Chair Deckard, Senator Starr, you're suggesting that some of the documents on which the fee would be collected are not sufficiently related to housing?
Absolutely not.
Then the answer is, I guess I would not want to opine off the top of my head on that. You're raising a serious, legitimate question, and I'd like to think about that a little more rather than just give you an off the top of my head response to that.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Other questions? So we'll check back with you maybe an hour from now. The first question that Senator Starr posed, generally the answer that we get is right when you draft, as you know, the bill, you'll get a note back that says, and so I didn't draft Senate Bill 38, I don't think I was the requester, it was a committee bill. But we generally will get a note back that says, can't start in the Senate.
I'm raising the issue, Mr. Chair. I think that this is a tax increase bill, and the Oregon Constitution is very clear. There are shades that when you're raising a fee that goes specifically to the purpose for which the fee is to cover the cost associated with whatever the fee is related to. I would suggest that the fees related that we're talking about raising in this bill have no nexus whatsoever to the issue that is at hand. I think it's something that we ought to have since we're not moving this bill forward today. I think there is an opportunity to get clarification for that on that particular issue from legislative counsel.
Thank you appreciate raising that another issue for Senate Bill 38. It's always good to get more issues to deal with on especially Senate Bill 38. Okay, so we'll get that one answered, and then obviously the very germane one for scheduling this bill and moving it out of Senate Committee on Finance and Revenue as soon as I possibly can, do we need a whole new bill? And so, Paul, if you could work with Legislative Council, and hopefully we'll get that decided by 10 or 11, because I know Senator Carter is willing to use a priority bill if necessary, but would hate to burn one if we can just get one amendment that accomplishes a few of the issues that we need to get amended into this bill.
And I think I can say fairly unequivocally the issues that have come before me, and I understand all the folks want to get into this draft, we can't do in this title.
Okay. Okay, that'll save us an hour. Thank you. Thanks, Harrison.
All right, thank you.
Okay, so Mary, do you want to go through the amendments just so we're clear on what's out there? And Sarah Morris, if you want to come up too as Mary goes through them, and you can talk about the one you've worked on.
Yes, I was hoping that I could bring to light just some of the differences across the amendments so that some of these options could be considered, and then when Harrison drafts the eventual bill, you have some what you want, actually. And I attached for you a sort of a summary sheet, and I only received the dash 8 and 9 this morning, so I couldn't get it into the summary sheet that was prepared last night, but I will do so in the future. But right now we've got the attachment shows a table that describes for you how the different versions of the bill and the amendment distribute money. Once it gets to the department, there has been a different distribution from the original bill. And so right now I believe that the dash 5 represents the most recent version from the Housing Alliance and the Department of Housing and Community Services, and their preferred distribution at this point would take 81% and put it into a housing development account, 10% into a housing emergency housing account, 9% into the homeownership account. The original bill had a different distribution of 75, 10, and 9 in the guarantee account, the emergency account, and the homeownership account. The dash 3 had a slightly different version. And again, each of these versions, for example, the dash 3 proposed by Senator Carter would distribute a 60, 40, and 20, and 6% into four different accounts. I think those issues might be resolved from testimony, and you might decide now, if you wish to do so, how you would like LC to draft the eventual amendment. The other issues that come up from the dash 4 and the dash 11, I believe Senator Morse will speak to those, were generated from testimony at prior hearing from the persons who have mining claims. And the two amendments that could be considered deal with a request for an exclusion or exemption from paying the documentary recording fee. The number 4, dash 4, would exclude or exempt them from paying the current $11 fee as well as the $15 proposed fee. The dash 11 would enable them to be exempt from just the proposed $15 fee. And the basis for their for the mining claimers' request is that they are required by federal law to record certain documents annually, and so they're being retaxed or subjected to a fee every year.
Sorry. Okay, well, we need to ask
the clerks had one as well. The dash 6 is from the treasurer, state treasurer, just a request that his name not be part of the process for the flow of funds. And there was the dash 7 from the county clerks, where they've requested that they receive a portion of 5% fee before the money is transferred to the department. And that's basically it, with a few minor changes, Mr. Chair.
Great. Okay. So, Senator Morse, we're up against the clock. You've worked on the mining, the dash 11s.
Yes, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair and colleagues. Very, very briefly, I'm appearing on behalf of constituents who find themselves drawn into this bill on an annual basis. Federal law, as staff has mentioned, requires an annual assessment be filed to maintain a valid mining claim. And so this would perpetuate on into the future as long as the claims were held as a fee. And I believe that it would be appropriate to consider excluding this group from that recording fee, and would ask your consideration for that, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
And those are encompassed in the dash 11s.
Those are in the dash 11s. Thank you.
Great.
And I didn't state my name for the record, Senator Frank Morse. Thank you. I'll be.
Thanks, Senator Morse.
Thank you.
Good Chair.
Two questions for you, Senator Munroe.
Yeah, Senator Morse, does your amendment simply provide an exception to the $15 fee, or does it also provide an exception to the fee that they're currently paying?
Mr. Chair, Senator Munroe, that's a federal requirement. The annual assessment. They have to file an annual assessment. I don't know what that fee is with the county for filing that, but this would be over and above anything that they currently pay. But it's a federal requirement that they file.
Yeah, I understand the federal requirement, but there's a current fee that's an administrative fee that's charged to everybody that files documents of this type. This doesn't exempt them from any current fee that they're paying.
That would not be the intent, certainly, to exclude them
from
that.
And we need to make sure of that.
Well, we're going to have to...
I'm in support of exempting them from the $15 fee, but not from any fees that they're currently paying.
That's correct. My understanding is the dash 11s achieve that. Senator Starr, do you have a question?
I would like to briefly talk about the dash 8s and dash 9s, if you...
We're just going to eat into... We're trying to keep to the schedule, and this bill will be coming back. So we will have another...
Real briefly, the dash 8s, Mr. Chair, narrow the scope of the fee to recording of mortgage documents, not all the other fees that are associated with this particular recording fee. I think it's it's more of a nexus to housing. When this bill was first explained to me, that was my understanding. It was the first page when you basically have a real estate transaction. So that's the dash eights.
And those are yours?
Yes.
Okay.
The dash nines deal with prevailing wage as it relates to affordable housing and these dollars. You know, I've had that conversation about how prevailing wage really isn't appropriate when you have a mix of funding for these affordable housing projects, and to have a small sliver of public money. I think we just want to make it real clear that these projects do not fall under the prevailing wage statute. So that's what the dash nine says.
Okay. So we just got those. Janet and Jennifer, do you want to come up and just talk about the very last amendment? And John from Senator Carter's office, do you want to be the? I don't see Senator Carter in here.
I'm sorry, we're talking about the dash nines.
Right. So the issue that hopefully you might address would be that did you come to some sort of agreement?
Senator Carter's here.
Oh. Senator Carter, would you like to come up? We're talking about your amendments or the agreement you helped broker to Senate Bill 38. Your timing is perfect. We just...
Chair Decker, members of the committee, my name is Janet Bird. I'm with the Housing Alliance. And I apologize. You're asking us to talk about the amendments that were drafted jointly to address the allocation of the fee revenue?
Have you found an agreement?
Yes. Carter, do you want me to go ahead?
Yes.
We have made an agreement and are recommending a shift in the percentages allocating... I don't have it in front of me. Allocating a higher percentage of revenue to the homeownership assistance account in order to just sort of give a little bit more equity in terms of the treatment of priorities as between rental housing, homelessness, and homeownership. And we've also talked about in some of the language about the use of the homeownership assistance account, looking at the effect and the impact of that money on declining homeownership rates in certain populations, minority populations.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good morning, Mr. Chairman, colleagues. Margaret Carter, House, I'm in Senate District 22. Old habits, hard to break. Senate District 22, North Northeast Portland. I am very pleased to see the work that has been done on Senate Bill 38. We've worked effectively with other people who were a part of what's happening with housing and rental possibilities in our community. And I don't need to go over the statistics with you again in terms of the gap that we see that is facing minority communities in this country and certainly in the state of Oregon. And I'm very pleased that your committee has been kind and generous enough with your time to allow us to work through this. And I'm very pleased that we have worked with all of our partners in being able to come to some kind of agreement along this line. And so I just want to say thank you very much for your leniency in allowing us to work this through. And my staff, John Christensen, has been working on that. And now Senator Gordley is here as well. And we're in the committee next door, so our apologies for coming over. So if you don't mind, I would like to be excused to go back to committee and continue our work on mental health issues.
No, you have to stay here.
Oh.
this bill has been so fun to work on that... You get to have fun with us now. Well, Legislative Council bought us some more time, so I think we'll have a few more days. But it seems like we're getting nods on that issue that we do have agreement. Now it's just getting it into the proper writing
exactly. And
the relating clause.
Yeah. Exactly.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Senator Gordley, do you?
So nice when people agree.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, I am Abel Gordley, representing Senate District 23 in Multnomah County, and wanted to be here, just confirm that we have a great partnership working on all the proper language that's going to allow us to advance a public policy that will serve all of Oregon. And, Mr. Chair, I wanted to particularly acknowledge and honor your leadership on this issue. This will be the first legislative session in which we intentionally affirm and acknowledge that there is a problem around minority home ownership. But we're going past acknowledging the problem to putting in place a public policy that will allow us to advance and move forward the affected communities. And I would just ask you, Mr. Chairman, and members of the committee, to, as you are doing this work, to put in front of you the Oregon Progress Board report that looked at the progress of Oregon's racial and ethnic populations in a number of benchmark categories, including home ownership, but also looking at education, employment, a number of benchmark categories, so that you have a way of looking at how the policy you're developing is directly responding to the findings and recommendations in that Oregon Progress Board report. This is great work that is taking place here, but it's only happening because of your intentional leadership, and I want to, again, honor that. And thank you very much for the opportunity.
Thank you, Senator. Appreciate the kind words and bringing this to our attention. Questions for this panel? Thank you. Thank you very much. One more meeting, and should have a bill. Okay, so that will do it for Senate Bill 38. It may come back on the schedule of Senate Bill 38, and because of council issues, it may come back in another form. But we will properly note that, and if have hold a public hearing if it comes back as another bill. Close the public hearing on Senate Bill 38. Open a public hearing on Senate Bill 518. Welcome, Senator George.
Good morning.
That's what I hear. Paul, are you staffing us?
Mr. Chairman.
Okay, and I'll call up Senator Walker and John Hottinger. Paul, do you want to tell us what Senate Bill 518 does?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate Bill 518 defines development assistance, and the first section of the bill goes on to require the Department of Economic and Community Development to submit an annual report listing all types of development assistance granted. It gives specifics on what the report should contain. It requires that recipients of development assistance submit application specifying their industry classification, number of employees expected to be hired, average wages, a series of other things, and a statement on why development assistance is needed. It requires each development assistance granting body to submit information to the Department of Community and Economic Development. The assistance granting party must submit information on the recipient's progress, track that progress, and if recipient fails to meet targets in agreement within specified time period, development assistance is eliminated and recaptured provisions are implemented. It does give the Department of Economic Development circumstances where those they can waive contractual provisions and then essentially renegotiate what the targets are. It also requires the Department of Economic Development to compile a report on the outcomes and effectiveness of recapture provisions. And it specifies that when the state enters a written agreement with development assistance recipient, the duty to maintain confidentiality of negotiations ends. We also, I might add, Mr. Chair, have a similar companion bill, House Bill 3264, scheduled for a hearing this afternoon in the House Revenue Committee.
Great. Senator Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Vicki Walker, State Senator, District 7. And, yes, there is a companion bill. I did not know that Representative Rosenbaum had the same thoughts I did. And so, lo and behold, we have two bills. And it's wonderful because joining me at the dais here is former Senator John Hottinger from Minnesota, who was the chief architect of their corporate expenditure accountability bill, and Charles Sheketoff with the Oregon Center for Public Policy. Mr. Sheketoff had no idea, Mr. Chair, that I was drafting this bill in response to an article he wrote that is at your desk there called Biotech Beer and the Public's Right to Know. He wrote this article in July of last year. I was rather busy in the interim, didn't have time to communicate, but I read the article. I do a lot of reading about things like this, and I thought, oh, what a grand idea. He was pretty upset that he couldn't get some information about some economic incentives that were being provided, and I'll let him talk about that. But what he did reference in the article was that Illinois, the state of Illinois, had passed a law in 2003 called the Corporate Accountability Tax Expenditure Act. So I sent up a note to Legislative Council immediately asking for the bill to be drafted, and it took 7 months, but the bill came out, and it is before you in Senate Bill 518. As I did the research, however, I discovered that Minnesota had passed a legislation in 1995, so they were on the cutting edge. Illinois, when they passed theirs in 03, became the 10th state, and I think we've increased that now. And what I'm going to have Mr. Hottinger talk to you about is how it has not scared away business, contrary to popular belief, and it's just required some more accountability. So let me just kind of cue it up a little bit. We talk about performance outcomes, and if you listen to the co-chairs, particularly the one who lives next door to me on the second floor, he's always talking about performance outcomes. That's all I hear coming out of the discussion from the co-chair. Those are great things, but you know what? We don't do performance outcomes for the tax subsidies that we provide in this state. We're very quick to write the blank check. We do that quite well and quite easily. And this morning, Mr. Chair, I have to tell you, I'm a little calmer now. I testified in the House on an E-zone bill, an enterprise zone bill, that would add 10 more enterprise zones to the state of Oregon. So I got all excited this morning, and now I'm much calmer. But we don't talk about performance outcomes. And so this bill sort of addresses, not sort of, it does address performance outcomes. We haven't been asking about these tax expenditures. Actually, quite a few people have, but no one's been listening. These are not an entitlement. And if you really would like a discussion about the benefits or not of tax subsidies, I would direct you to read this book, Rethinking Growth Strategies by Robert Lynch. And he wrote it. He's a member of the Economic Policy Institute. It is a nonprofit, nonpartisan research organization that seeks to broaden the public debate about strategies to achieve a prosperous and fair economy. And one of the things, there are many things in this book where he dispels the myths about tax subsidies, and he states right on page 3, I read that this morning, and I think it's worth repeating, myths and exaggerations, when they are repeated often enough, may become etched in people's consciousness as facts. So we have grown to believe that we need to offer subsidies, and it has become a race to the bottom. I have heard that if we don't offer these tax breaks, we are not friendly to business. Well, he clearly states in his publication that businesses don't really much care about that perception. They care about the quality of life, the workforce, and other issues, and they don't come to Oregon because we offer the best tax breaks. Of course, if we hand it to them, they'll take it. And I quoted Paul O'Neill before in this committee for that purpose. Let me also state that in 2003, Alan Pittman with Eugene Weekly, and I quoted that recently, but in his story called Boondoggle, he indicates in his story that in 2000, a study commissioned by Oregon's largest business lobby, Associated Oregon Industries, shows tax breaks don't work. Amazing. I didn't hear much about that from AOI, but the study was conducted nonetheless. And I would also commission you to look at Good Jobs First, a great organization who did a research report called Subsidizing Low-Wage Jobs, and it's an analysis of the first economic development deals disclosed under Illinois' new accountability law. And one of the things that they state in here in the report, which is what Senate Bill 518 is all about, is that disclosure is a bedrock reform for any public program. Disclosure and accountability. Now, one of our colleagues doesn't think that's such a great idea. In the Portland Business Journal, Senator Ted Ferrioli, in response to a question about this bill, likened the proposal to, quote, causing the beneficiary of the tax benefit to wear a scarlet letter that brands themselves as guilty. It's passive-aggressive behavior, and it's hostile to business. Well, yeah, it is asking business to wear a scarlet letter, and it's A for accountability, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee. There should be nothing that business should fear from being accountable for those blank checks that we write to them to provide subsidies, and in return, what we get. Do we get jobs? Do we get health care? That's what Senate Bill 518 does for you. Mr. Warner explained it in detail. I can go over it more, but quite frankly, I'd like to give the time to my guests who've flown out here. But probably the sweetest provision in this bill that I love is what is commonly called the clawback provision, and it's recapturing those tax subsidies that we give away, and those companies don't meet the requirements, then gosh darn it, give it back. Because I was on the campaign trail a lot in this last election, got a lot of sunburns, a lot of moments with people on their doorsteps, and they're all pretty angry that we never seem to have enough money. And quite frankly, I think we give away too much. And if I want to ask for more money from my constituency, I need to show that we've been accountable for it in Oregon. And then the other part that I think Mr. Sheketoff will love is on page 7 of the bill, lines 26 through 31, and it says that once the state enters into a written agreement with a person contemplating locating a firm in the state, or you announce an agreement, all that information becomes subject to disclosure. So with that, that's a perfect cue up to my guest from Minnesota, who will talk about their online reporting system and what it has actually done to increase business in their state. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Welcome, former Senator Hottinger. Hopefully I pronounced that correctly.
Close enough, Mr. Chair.
Minnesota, we're often told Minnesota is similar to Oregon, so hopefully your trip is verifying that.
Well, and thank you, Chair Deckard and Vice Chair George and members of the committee. It's an honor to appear here, and you've already stolen some of my thunder, Mr. Chair, because I think Oregon and Minnesota have a lot in common. This is, frankly, the first time I've been to the western side of Oregon, and now I see the natural beauty that you have in this part of the state. And it's really a great trip, and I've appreciated the opportunity to be here. I served in the Minnesota State Senate. I'm sorry, my name is John Hottinger. I'm from St. Paul, Minnesota, 214 Oak Grove Place in St. Paul. I've been out of the Senate now 2 months. I have to remember the process as I go along here. But I served for 16 years in the Minnesota State Senate. I chose not to run for re-election this year. We, like you, have a citizen legislature, and at some point the legislature overwhelms the citizen part, and I wanted to go back to that opportunity. But during those 16 years, I served in the Tax Committee quite a bit, and for 8 years served in the Tax Conference Committee, where things get put together and ultimately decided in the legislature. And I've been interested in public subsidy aspect of government subsidies to private businesses all that time. But maybe more importantly, I've been very active in the Council of State Governments. I was national chair in 2004 and have been active a number of years, and also in NCSL. And what I've done there has been learning from my colleagues across the country. And that's one of the things that I cherish about serving in state government, is we are the laboratories for experimentation. We make sovereign decisions that are often innovative and help inform our colleagues in other other states, not only from the things that work out, but from the things that don't. And I hope I can share some of our experience in Minnesota, where we've had a reporting law since 1995 for state government and for local governments. And it includes a variety of things, including some of the things accepted by this bill, which I certainly support and am proud here to be supportive of. For instance, tax increment financing is accepted from this bill. It's always been part of Minnesota's. We went through a process in which we have now built public support and political support across ideologies and party lines. So it has become part of our culture to have this reporting. And Mr. Chair and members, we've also learned from Oregon and other things. Your decisions in land use and in health care especially have been informative in our debates in Minnesota and how we deal with those issues. So that's the kind of exchanges that states can have that are beneficial to all of us. Let me talk, and I've submitted written testimony. I know enough not to sit here and read it. So let me talk more in summary of our history and ultimately, most importantly, what's happened since we've had reporting requirements since 1995. It started in 1994 in Minnesota when we got a report from an organization that looked at tax expenditures. We have a tax expenditure report, as I understand you do. And it pointed out that there really wasn't much accountability for the dollars that were being spent in general in tax expenditures. What that did is engender a discussion in Minnesota to determine what should we be doing to make better decisions, not saying yes or no, subsidies are bad, but better decisions about providing them. And it led to a discussion that we needed visibility and public participation. We needed written standards, criteria, and goals as to what return the public is getting for these subsidies. And what we encouraged was having those before we made the subsidy, but also to include them in written agreements. We needed accountability, public information on why the subsidy was granted, what was expected, and progress towards the goals that were expected. And we also needed a mechanism for consequences if there was failure to meet the goals. In 1995, I introduced legislation, or 1994 yet, I introduced legislation to start doing that. It was a reporting proposal. It didn't get off to a good start. The governor vetoed it. Now, I must tell you that I've seen Senator Walker testify earlier this morning, so I hate following her. But I had similar energy when the governor vetoed it in a broadly distributed quote. Governor and I are now very good friends, I should say, as a preface. I said, when the business community empties its pockets at night, it finds loose change, lint, and Governor Carlson. it wasn't well received at the time by the governor. But it triggered a discussion which was important with his economic development people. And we talked about it during the summer and found ways, because they were concerned about the Scarlet Letter. They were concerned about the bookwork, the paperwork, because it applied to every local subsidy from every local government in addition to the state. They weren't concerned about the state. And the next year we passed the bill. We passed the bill on a bipartisan basis. We had free market legislators and pro-government legislators on board, and we passed the bill with the governor's strong support. So we worked through that initial quote, at least, and got it passed. Since then, I can summarize and tell you there's been no discernible negative impact in business in Minnesota. The information that we now receive provides accountability, which is certainly the buzzword of the times, but also was fundamentally important in assessing future decisions. Minnesota's culture on economic subsidies has changed. We're emphasizing the economic strengths of our state and the attributes of the state. And very frankly, that's an area where I think there's a great deal of similarity between Oregon and Minnesota. And we also now have better informed judgments on the decisions we do make. It was not without problems the first year. We worked through those problems. We now have broad support. Our governor, who is the most conservative governor we've ever had in Minnesota, is also the most business-oriented governor we've ever had, initiated a broad job authority to reduce taxes for jobs in essentially enterprise zones. Without question, he included the provisions of the statute in that bill for accountability, protect taxpayer dollars as he tries to build jobs. So it has become part of our culture. Let me build a little more on the history, because in 1995 we passed the original reporting provision. The next year, the leading lobbyist for the most liberal organization in the state of advocacy and the leading lobbyist for the Chamber of Commerce appeared jointly together, us in the Senate and the House, and said, well, we should be doing even more in making sure business subsidies are accountable. And we created a commission. The commission went around the state, took testimony. I know most commissions end up doing that. They file a report and nobody looks at it again. At least that's our experience. In Minnesota, with the chamber lobbyist, the progressive group lobbyist, the most free market senator, the most liberal House member, members of the business community, the academic community, we went around the state and issued a unanimous support, unanimous report, saying that we ought to take this further. We ought to requirement disclosure at the local level or at the state level. We ought to have public hearings with votes on subsidies. We ought to have accountability. We ought to have written criteria on wages. We ought to have written criteria on jobs beforehand and then follow through. And if they don't go through with their promises, find a mechanism for getting the money back. That first $1 million clawback we got a lot of publicity. But it's now been followed by others. In Minnesota, if you don't meet a subsidy requirement, you not only have to pay back, and it can be structured in a way that's proportional, you not only have to pay back the money, you're not eligible for any more subsidies for the next 5 years. So we've had an experience, and maybe I can best identify it this way. When I came out with the proposal in 1995, the biggest opponent was the Economic Development Association of Minnesota, made up of all the local economic developers and all the local economic development officials. I was not their favorite person. And they continued to fight, even after the reporting law, which they said was just a bunch of paperwork, and even after we had those hearings. And I worked with them, and they saw what happened. And you'll like this. In 2001, I was their Senator of the Year, because they found out these proposals are workable, they are valuable, and they help make local governments make good decisions along with state government. Let me end by summarizing one key part of my written testimony. The effects on business in Minnesota. Our small business community continues to thrive. We have Walmarts and big companies. We have national Fortune 500 companies. Actually, we're in the top 10 of states with national Fortune 500 companies. And it's grown since this law was passed in 1995. Business journals have considered Minneapolis-St. Paul area one of the top three places to take your new business. Minnesota is a high-tax state. Even our governor, who would like to make it a lower-tax state, acknowledges we're always going to be a high-tax state. We don't have an ocean. We don't have any mountains. We're out in the middle of nowhere from other people's perspective, which we kind of like. But if you draw a line from Maine down to Texas and then back up to Washington, within that line, our economic strength is the strongest of any of those states. Those states have varied tax policies. They have varied incentives. But what we're talking about is quality of life, as you do. What we talk about is a good educated workforce, as you do. And our economy continues to grow and grow well. We expect 1 million new residents in Minneapolis-St. Paul area in the next 12 years. We have some problems with that, but we're trying to deal with them in some of the ways Oregon has done that. So we have had success with our business community, I won't say because of this, but certainly despite this. They have adopted and have been supportive. There has been no effort to amend their legislation or change our legislation in the last 7 years when we passed the final version. And the consequences are clear. Let me end with a quote from the head of the Economic Development Association of Minnesota in a report done by Good Jobs First. And that's the same group that the senator referred to, and they've done three analyses of the outcomes in Minnesota as a result of this law. The head of the Economic Development Association says that economic developers in Minnesota now seem to be changing to cooperation, especially on the regional basis, rather than competition. I think Minnesota has set itself up to expect a little more. I think this issue has gotten a lot of coverage. I think people are pretty educated about it, even the 9-to-5 guy. So we have changed our culture, and I'm not presumptuous enough to tell you exactly what Oregon should do. Our bill has differences from the one the senator introduced. You have to organize these. You have to do what is best within your state's culture and within your state's environment. But I can say affirmatively and without any reservation that the bill we passed in Minnesota made our accountability for using taxpayer dollars much stronger, didn't impact our businesses in any negative way, and helped make economic development decisions not only better and wiser, but more public, which I think is something we all share in trying to accomplish. Thank you very much for your time. I appreciate it very much.
Thank you, Senator Huttinger. Questions for Senator Huttinger? Yes, Senator Burdick and then Senator Starr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for coming all this way to share your experiences. I'm intrigued by the clawback provision. Does Minnesota's law have that kind of provision where if the company doesn't live up to its commitments that the money needs to be returned?
Mr. Chair, Senator Burdick, yes, it does. And it has been part of the provision since the early reporting. It has been made much firmer with the 1999 and 2000 legislation that we worked on a cooperative basis. And frankly, was not an issue with the business community by the time we reached to that area. If I can add, one of the reasons our local Chamber of Commerce, the State Chamber of Commerce, which is the biggest business organization in Minnesota, has been supportive of it, is they think that it recognizes that subsidies to individual businesses are contrary to a free market approach. They would rather have broader changes in our tax or other kind of policies to encourage business, since small business creates most of the jobs in Minnesota, rather than having pointed, targeted benefits and subsidies to individual businesses. So they became very supportive from a free market standpoint that it was the way to go. But we've had clawbacks. They've been used. They've been kept track of. And by the way, all of this information is on the Economic Development Department's website.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Senator Huttinger, for your testimony, for coming. I appreciate it. It's fascinating. I'm interested. You mentioned that while Senate Bill 518 doesn't contemplate including tax increment financing, your bill or your law in Minnesota did. Talk a little bit about the interaction between the state and the local governments as you went down this road toward this transparency and accountability.
Mr. Chairman? Mr. Chairman, Senator Starr, the first year was rough. I mean, we were imposing some additional. There are procedures already in tax increment financing, as I am sure they are here. But that was the tool local governments use most frequently. And that was the original resistance from the economic development administrators. We worked through that. And they now understand and accept. There's, again, I can't emphasize the fact there's no opposition to this now in Minnesota. And they tried out. It was more procedures. It was more written documents. They had many of the procedures already in effect. So it has now become natural for them to do that. And they're finding there is public involvement, which the Economic Development Association president pointed out. But that's good. It helps them make better decisions. But there was some reluctance. We also had economic development corporations that were set up by cities, and they would approve things, and there wouldn't be a public vote. They're now required to do that. Again, after the transition of thinking about it and change of culture, it was adopted, and it's been working successfully.
Mr. Chair, just a follow-up.
Thanks.
So you're requiring those kinds of public hearings in local cities or local counties if these kind of incentives are provided to businesses. So it's not just a hearing through your state economic development commission or committee, but it's also those hearings are done locally?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Starr, if St. Paul, where I live now, is going to do an economic subsidy or a tax increment financing proposal to help a business or a group of businesses, there has to be a public hearing. There has to be, well, actually, it has to be two public hearings. There has to be a recorded vote. And there has to be a written agreement, which includes a clawback, which includes wage goals, which had been set as an ordinance prior to any individual subsidy. And there has to be job goals. So, yes, every single subsidy provided by local governments in Minnesota has to have that process.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator George.
Senator, thank you so much for being here. Welcome. I hope you enjoy the beauty while you're here, and we'll share yours one of these days. At the bottom of the first page, you made a statement relative to the Chamber of Commerce, and it is something that each one of us, I believe, has thought about, and that is, here's what it says, primarily because the Chamber felt, that the law helped protect Minnesota's small business from unfair competition from subsidies to others. And I'm going to tell you, each one of us in this building has had that exact same thought. Is that, you know, are we providing at the expense of our own local, you know, startup businesses and small businesses, are we sacrificing them because we want to subsidize the large? I had a lobbyist when I first got here 10 years ago made a statement to me. He said, you know what? He said, big business uses big government to stifle competition. And then if you add another piece onto that in which we actually then reward big big business with large subsidies, you know, it really does provide a real disadvantage to small business. Would you comment, have you seen an encouragement of small business in Minnesota?
Mr. Chairman, Senator George, I think that's a perceptive comment. What we've seen, and as you know, it was built on a kind of an approach that it harms small business to give advantages to someone else coming in, because they have to compete. I think what we've seen is our small businesses have been put in a less disadvantageous position. That is, when a community or the state wants to bring in a big business, there has to be public discussion. There has to be a recognized impact in terms of how it's going to impact the economy. There has to be a public debate about that. That has, in many instances, helped. Frankly, I'll put it in the context of some big box stores, which have frequently requested local subsidies to come in. And that has always, in recent years, engendered a very, very visible and public debate in those communities. Very often, those big box stores still come in, but they're not subsidized by the local communities. And that's where the impact has changed. At least they start out on a competitive basis where they're not having a tax or other kind of subsidy advantage over who's already there.
Other questions for...
Another one?
Please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is for Senator Walker. Would you look favorably in amending this bill to include that tax increment financing at the local level? I mean, it seems like we can tackle this from one level, but I think it might make sense to look at what's happening locally as well. And tax increment financing is something that's done broadly throughout Oregon, and it's one of the largest incentives, I think, that is used to benefit businesses. Would you be supportive of amending this to broaden it just a bit?
Mr. Chair and Senator Starr, I'm agreeable just about anything. This bill I took from Illinois, and I think Representative Rosenbaum took her bill from some other state from model legislation. I am open to anything as long as we have this discussion. As you can see from the testimony today, there's no need to fear this bill, and I believe the governor's office is going to testify today that they support the concept, and I think there are details that need to be worked out, but I'm totally amenable to doing that. And if you'd like to be involved in a work group, oh my God, how many work groups have I had this session? But this is probably, out of all of the bills I've drafted this session, this is the most important to me, because I think this will bring accountability to how we spend money. It will take things, I was going to bring that tax expenditure book we've seen, it'll take things out of that book and put it up on the internet so that regular citizens can see how the state is spending their money and how they can benefit from that. You know, as I said, some of those tax breaks can be beneficial, but we need to see. So, and public hearings at the local level on tax increment financing is a fabulous idea.
Well, Mr. Chair, I'm intrigued by this because I think that the incentives work, and I think what it does is it shows that the investments that we're going to make pay off. And so, on the flip side, I think it's not going to be a gotcha. It's going to be, wow, this is great.
That's right.
You know, and it's something that the citizenry and everybody can understand. I think we take, let's peel the veil back and demonstrate for everybody to see that when we do provide incentives and we do bring 1,000 jobs to Hillsborough, and you know, this is what it means to our economy and to our local communities.
Just to follow up on that, so you've had this experience in Minnesota. How many tax laws have been changed due to the bill that you helped usher through?
Mr. Chairman, I'm not quite sure what you mean.
As you put this out there, has it brought a many changes in terms of how you to business taxes, where people have rethought, this incentive is not working for us, this has not been an effective incentive, therefore we're going to go petition our legislature and actually change that law? There have been five or...
Mr. Chairman, the way it's worked is that it's not changed. For instance, the governor's new effort to have no taxes if you build in rural parts of Minnesota. It hasn't changed whether or not that law still exists. What is done is required that there be accountability for that law. that we know, as Senator Starr just pointed out, whether it's successful, which some are, and whether it's not successful, which some aren't. And it's helped make the distinguishing decisions about what's most likely to succeed as a tax subsidy or some other kind of subsidy, and what's not most likely to succeed. We didn't intend this, and that's how we built a unanimous support from this commission, to be a, gee, subsidies are bad. It was intended to show which ones work and which ones don't. And it hasn't. But when we went through our biotechnology grants, as most states have, were incentives, this law, was without thinking, was included as something that had to be met in any biotechnology incentive. When we went through our efforts to, we're trying to get a cargo airport in Minnesota. When we went through our efforts to attract a cargo airport to Minnesota, the requirements of this bill were automatically included. So I think Senator Starr really touched on a key point. This can help distinguish where the wise decisions are made and where the ones that we shouldn't make again are made.
And so, you know, I think the other, and your Minnesota experience would be really helpful, one of the other at least pauses that we would have is we, 20 years ago, were a very single dominated natural resource based economy, and by taking a pretty aggressive traded sector, and that's the wealth creation, would argue a little bit on the small business in terms of where the wealth that actually moves down to small business growth is created, but it's been a pretty successful strategy for our state in terms of diversifying our economy, bringing in numbers of new clusters to the state, and certainly taxes are just one component of that, but it's been, I think, no better testimony than our largest private sector employer, Intel, that manufactures nothing in California today, but more jobs in Oregon than anywhere else in the world are located here. And they made that decision 15, 20 years ago that they would just stop manufacturing one job in the state of California. And as we invest the revenue from, and Intel's just one example, there's so many others, this session, it's an increase in revenue that we're able to invest in education, higher education, perhaps healthcare for all. The only concern would be upsetting that apple cart in any fashion, because we know from the early 80s and certainly just 4 years ago, we are particularly susceptible to an income tax decrease, and the effects that cutting 17 days from our school year were, and having the 46th worst funded higher education system, and what that does to our prospects. And I don't know if you would want to weigh in on just upsetting what at least has been a good diversification of our economy, and Oregonians as a state have benefited from.
Mr. Chairman, I was the majority leader of the Minnesota State Senate in 2003 when we had a $4.5 billion budget deficit, and I certainly was familiar with the very tough decisions that had to be made in Oregon during your budget deficit. Time Magazine and others have relayed that to us, and we made similar very, very difficult decisions, but we never once questioned whether or not we should have more accountability and visibility for business subsidies. The business community didn't suggest that as part of the way to resolve it. Now, we are lucky. We have grown, as you have, into a much more diverse economy. We used to be wheat fields and forests and water. But now Minneapolis and St. Paul, especially in the last 20 years, have grown into a major financial industry state. They can locate anywhere. But maybe the best example, when you may have heard of the Mall of America, it's the largest shopping center, and it attracts this. I find this hard to believe. It attracts more visitors than any other place in the country, except Branson, Missouri. I guess what I find it hard to believe is that we're behind Branson. It's a tremendous resource for us financially.
Fabulous shopping experience.
Isn't it a significant expansion is contemplated there?
A significant expansion is contemplated, and they want $288 million of state dollars. We're going through an analytical approach. Not we. I'm not there anymore. They're going through an analytical approach that includes making sure there are public hearings, making sure there are written documents. I don't think they're going to get the $288 million. I don't think they can move the expansion to Michigan. So it's made it part of the public debate. So even in the very major employers, and certainly Mall of America is, very major tourist attractant, as the Mall of America is, we're looking at it, we think, from a wiser standpoint. You know, you can go back retrospectively and try and decide whether whether proposals were valuable. And certainly some are. You know, I'm not opposed to all business subsidies, never have been. But this gives you a tool for something as simple as making a better decision and holding accountability into the process.
Do you have time for maybe one or two more questions? Senator Monroe, did you? Senator Burdick?
Well, I just wanted to, when Senator Starr mentioned the local level, we already have a program that has some of the elements of this, and that's a strategic investment program, which Intel has actually used. And they have the written agreements, the public agreements. They even have a clawback provision, except it's not mandatory, which raises a question in my mind, is the recovery mechanism mandatory in Minnesota, or is it discretionary with the governor, with the government?
Mr. Chair, Senator Burdick, no, it's mandatory, it has added to the decision making process on both sides. That the business makes a determination as to whether or not they can fulfill the goals that they're expected of them, which is not an unreasonable expectation. So both parties look at it quite closely. But it's mandatory for the local governments by state law.
Well, it seems that's really a healthy thing, Mr. Chairman, because right now, with no accountability, a business would have to be crazy for not requesting aid. And so if they know what's involved in the subsidy, then they'll be more cautious about which ones they request. Has that been your experience in Minnesota?
Mr. Chair, Senator Burdick, it has. And let me give you a quick example. I know you've got time problems. We always do in hearings. But a quick example. In my district, Walmart wanted to build a big distribution center. And they came in, and we were competing for Iowa, or, you know, the same old story we always hear. And it was 1,500 jobs, which in my community is a gigantic deal. And my community said, well, we can do that, but we can't give you a subsidy because we don't think it measures up. They still built the distribution center in my district. And the public has a copy of every single document going to that distribution center, including the wage levels that are expected, including the job creation levels that are expected. And it has a clawback.
We're going to get short on time here. Other questions? Mr. Sheckenhoff, I want to give the other panel a chance.
I have a few brief comments I wanted to make, if I
please.
Could. Okay, thank you. Chuck Sheckenhoff, Executive Director of the Oregon Center for Public Policy. I wanted to talk a little bit about how this fits in with the tax expenditure report, as well as the House bill that's been mentioned. House Bill 3264, which was introduced at the by Representative Rosenbaum, and the House ended up being the committee bill, revenue committee bill, is based on model legislation by Good Jobs First, where they took the Illinois law, some of the aspects of the Minnesota law, Maine's law, and put the best aspects together. And so it goes broader. It does cover tax increment finance. It covers the full range. And they both call it having a unified development budget. The model legislation does a better job. Imagine, if you will, if someone said to you as a legislator, how much does the state spend supporting economic development? You can't put your finger on a dollar. Now, those of you who are members of the Revenue Committee, you know that in the tax expenditure report, there has been a categorization of some tax expenditures as economic development. You could throw that number out. You could maybe then start fishing through the rest of the budget for stuff. What the model legislation does is it pulls that all together. It shows how much is the state spending on economic development. And there's some gray areas, and you have to make decisions of, you know, how much of higher ed is economic development, how much of K-12 is, if any, community colleges and the like. But it pulls all that together. So it pulls the budget together with tax expenditures plus the spending stuff, like from a strategic reserve fund that the governor has. You know, in 1995, the legislature enacted the law that created the tax expenditure report. It was called the Budget Accountability Act of 1995. There's a few sections and a very long omnibus tax credit bill. I would joke with the late Shirley Gold that it was the most expensive tax expenditure report in the country, because it was in the bill that extended a lot of sunsets and created some new tax expenditures. But that took years to get that enacted. Before I started lobbying in 93, it had been pushed. And there was fear that, oh, what would this do? All it has done is has really improved the debate. I actually know of only two tax expenditures in that first report that were either eliminated or reduced significantly as a result of that report. It was the tax-free gift packs of cigarettes, and that took a couple sessions to get rid of, and the fact that lottery winnings were fully tax-free, and the legislature set over 600 as taxable. But more to that, and this gets to the chair's question about what's been the impact of the Minnesota law, it's improved the debate. It's given you context when other measures have come in. It gives you context to how many of our tax expenditures don't have sunsets. That was sort of the first big eye-opener when that came out. And what's the evaluation of them? Now, the evaluation in that it certainly could be improved, but it gives context, and it's improved, I think, the decision-making. It's improved the ability of the lobby to push for and against different public policies. This is a very transparent state. We have a very good public records law. We have a very transparent budget process on the ways and means side, more than most other states. And you can get the very detailed budgets. When the governor announces the budget, all the documents are therefore public. That's not real clear that we have that on the spending side on some of the economic development incentives that we have. And so what this will do is just, I think it should be the Budget Accountability Act of 2007, essentially. Because what it does is it pulls together the economic development budget for the state and makes them clear so you can go online and look up whether things are working. And it's not a bill that's against tax expenditures. I think Senator Starr is absolutely correct. It's the same fear that people had when the tax expenditure report would come out. And I had nonprofit organizations going, oh, no, don't disclose that we don't pay property taxes. Well, you know what? You're not going to lose that. That's not going to be lost just because it gets disclosed. And so good things will also get disclosed. If you believe that you've been doing good policy over the years, you'll have good results in the report. So there really shouldn't be any fear to the disclosure. I guess I'll end it there. I just think that it's good policy. I think both bills need to be organized. They were put in as the model legislation, the Illinois law, and they got caught in the jam at legislative council, so we couldn't do amendments at the drafting stage. They need to reflect that we use a biennial system, not an annual system here still on budgeting and whatnot. But I think I would use the House bill more as a model because it goes further than the Senate bill, but they're both very good bills and get us in the right direction.
Thank you. Questions for Mr. Shekhatov? Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair, just a comment. Based on Mr. Shekhatov's testimony, when I get the emails from OCPP, instead of automatically deleting them, I might just read them a little more often. So, it's for whatever it's worth.
Thank you, Senator Hottinger. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr.
Chairman. Hope you're able to stay for the weekend, or if you can't, we understand. Come
Mr.
back.
Mr. Chairman, I can assure you I'll be back.
Okay. Good. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, so we have one more panel on this. Jim Craven. Alan, do you want to testify? Yeah, please. And Mike, do you want to come up with them? Okay, so we'll do. Jim, do you want to sit next? You've done it before. Sit next to Mr. Alley.
Pleasure.
Hi, Mr. Craven.
Good morning.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, Vice Chairman, members of the committee. My name's Alan Alley. I'm the Deputy Chief of Staff in the Office of the Governor. I'm also the chairman of the board of directors of a company called Pixelworks that I co-founded in 1997. And I've been virtually working in economic development in the state since 1988 when I made my first venture investment in a company called InFocus Systems. I want to bring a perspective to you today that maybe is, I may be unique in my ability to do this. We live in an extremely competitive world, and it's very different than 1988. Global competition for jobs is ruthless. It knows no boundaries. It knows no borders. I don't think all of us really truly understand the scope of global competition. I'm personally very familiar with what's going on in China, and I wanted to give you an example of one science park that I'm familiar with in Shanghai. it's almost impossible for me to convey the scale of this science park. It's over 6,100 acres. To put it in perspective, that's 14 times the size of the Intel Rondler Acre campus. It's 27 times the size of the entire main campus of the University of Oregon, and it's 75 times the size of Disneyland. It was founded in July of 1992. It comprises several discrete zones, including innovation, high-tech industry, scientific research, interestingly enough, education and residential. It includes all those. In August 1999, Shanghai created Focus on Zhangjiang and identified the IC industry, the software industry, biomedicine as the principal industries of this park. Let me give you some data. By the end of 2005, the park had produced 4,297 new businesses, attracted foreign investment of $13.7 billion, had a fixed asset investment of $9 billion. Companies in the park had applied for over 4,000 patents, with around 1,000 of them granted. And this is just one of many of these parks that are in China. And I haven't even talked about India. The bill before you today speaks about disclosure and accountability, and I resonate with both of those things. Fortunately and unfortunately, we're not in Shanghai. We're not able to make the levels of investment required to compete head-to-head with Shanghai. We have to be smarter, we have to be more innovative, and we have to work harder. We must use the limited resources that we have to do what Americans have always done best, innovate and change the rules of the game. We must use disclosure and accountability as tools to help us use our limited resources to the best advantage. When I took the position with Governor Kulongoski, he asked me to focus on creating jobs for all Oregonians. This is a challenge that I took on, and it's one of the reasons that I decided to take this job. I believe that we can compete globally and that we can create family wage jobs in Oregon. The announcement of Solar World coming to Oregon is an example of this. I think everyone who's been working with me knows I'm focused on doing things differently and I'm focused on doing them better. The good news is I'm getting universal support in my job from just about everybody in government that I'm working with. This is especially true with the management staff that I've been working with at the Department of Energy and the Oregon Economic Community Development Department. We're working together to investigate new innovative ways of attracting companies to our state and retaining companies in our state. I repeat, we can't compete head-to-head with China. We can't compete dollar for dollar. We must innovate, and we are. Senate Bill 518 offers us an opportunity to reinforce that Oregon is equipped and determined to compete in the global market by recruiting and retaining the businesses that are the lifeblood of our economy. As we move into implementation, we must remember that recruitment and retention is an extremely confidential process. Companies carefully guard their plans from competitors. We must respect this, but at the same time, we need to document and report our agreements so we can evaluate and improve. Businesses call this a closed-loop continuous improvement process. The best companies do it. We need to do it as well. I'm not an expert in 518. I've looked through it a little bit. And I think there are some things, as Senator Walker mentioned, that we need to look at. We need to, I like the term, organize around it. But I think there's a framework there that we can work with. And I'm looking forward to working with the governor's office, with the senators, to do that and implement a good bill for the state. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Alley. Questions for Mr. Alley? Just one, and as you mentioned, your time in China, and this kind of taps into your prior experience. Thomas Friedman's words from about a year and a half ago, I think it was in a speech, the author of many books, But the World is Flat, that they are coming for your jobs. It's just stuck in my it has just stuck with me in a very powerful way, how he described children in a third grade class in Indonesia and how they are, in the most beautiful fashion, coming for your jobs in America. How we deal with taxes and land use and things, that states are pretty limited. How important is, as you travel through China, there's obviously many cost advantages, labor, land. How important are taxes to a company in flat panel display or semiconductor or solar in terms of where they locate their next wealth builder or manufacturing plant?
Mr. Chairman, Co-Chairman, Senators, taxes are a very important part of recruiting and retaining these large manufacturing operations. That science park that I talked to you about, there are the ones that I can think of, there are three semiconductor manufacturing companies in that science park with multiple fabs. One that we deal with has three fabs in that science park. Part of it is the world is flat, and those fabs can go anywhere. There was a recent announcement by a company that we know that's making an investment in China. The communication systems now in the world allow you to be in Indonesia or in Oregon. There are advantages to being in Oregon. There are quality of life advantages to being in Oregon, workforce advantages to being in Oregon. It's all part of the component, but those economic zones that they create in China are massive magnets to draw those foundries there. I actually mentioned the other day in an interview that one of the reasons that I think the display industry in the United States has struggled is we don't have display fabs in the United States. We missed that. All of the liquid crystal displays that you see and you use are either made in Japan, Korea, or now starting to be in China. So it is an important factor.
Chair?
Yes, Senator Burr.
But you didn't really answer the question of what their tax policy is in these parks.
Oh, it varies. I'm sorry, Mr. Chair and Senator Burdick. It varies from park to park. I never took advantage of it. In fact, you indirectly called me a crazy businessman earlier today when you said that you'd be crazy if you didn't take advantage of tax incentives. And that's not something that isn't something that I've needed or required in my business, because we're a IP company and an intellectual property company. I don't know what the tax incentives of that park are. I know that they provide tax incentives, they provide land, they provide construction subsidies, they provide workforce training, they have universities on site. It's a complete turnkey operation to provide facilities for those companies.
My understanding is they build the roads, they build airports nearby.
Airport, maglev train. Right. It's incomprehensible. I mean, the only thing, you have to be there. Maybe you have been, and I'm preaching to the choir. But if you've been there, the scale is overwhelming. It's what I say. It's 27 times the University of Oregon campus and 14 times the size of the Intel Rondler Acres campus.
Other questions for Mr. Alley? Mr. Craven.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Jim Craven, American Electronics Association. I know you're running late on time. Let me just hit on one point about the bill and not debate the broader philosophical arguments, because I think you've heard them from the previous witnesses. And I did also hear from the chief sponsor some mention of maybe these details in the bill are not quite tuned up to where even she would want them to be. So I wanted to acknowledge that. There's a lot of specifics in this, and we've basically been talking about the high level. Should there be openness and transparency in government? We agree, and I think the chief sponsor of this measure has been a stalwart in calling for openness and transparency in government, and we don't have anything to fear from that. I think some of the statements already made that we believe many of the economic incentives that this state has done, both in fundamental tax and in direct targeted incentives The proof's in the pudding. I mean, it'd be very hard to argue that Oregon hasn't done a whole lot of really smart things in the last 20 years to help grow and diversify its economy. So I don't think that's the issue, is that there's a whole bunch of secret stuff here that we're just pocketing money and we don't want any the light of day to be shown on it. There are a whole lot of specifics in this bill, too, that I would encourage you in your busy schedules to maybe actually, if you haven't had the chance to read through some of the specifics, the kinds of detail that is required from a company in applying for an incentive and the kind of detail that the state would have to aggregate, we do find troubling at the micro level. Such things, I'll just hit a few. On page one, development assistance is defined as all other programs and tax credits designed to promote large business. I don't know what a large business is in this bill. I don't know what words like all other do trouble me in as a former staff person. There are a definition of new employee in this bill. It's troubling because it's defined as essentially a new employee cannot include someone who has a job somewhere else. But in your disclosures of applying for development assistance, you have to identify the number of, quote, new employees. That's pretty hard. Most times when somebody opens a firm, most of the people you hire are people who have a job. Most people are working, and you hire them away from somebody else. That's not in 3264. It's defined elsewise, so that could just be another drafting issue. But to say that a company has to specify how many new employees, but not knowing which ones they're going to hire from somebody else or hire from the unemployment rolls, it's just a troubling detail. The specifications of when you apply for assistance, you have to, according to the bill, specify the anticipated start dates of all new employees. That's a pretty high hurdle to say how many people we're going to hire and on what day. But that is in the bill. Total payroll of all your employees, the average wages of all employees, and job classifications. I'm just trying to give you a flavor of some of the specificity that's required in here. And then just one more. In compiling this unified economic report, the OECDD is required to account for the amount of uncollected or diverted state tax revenues resulting from each type of assistance. I think that is, so we're going to figure out how much is uncollected or diverted, but there's no part of the analysis that talks about how much is gained, how much is generated, how much new income is a result of a project taking place. So I'm going to stop there just to tell you that there's a lot of troubling specifics in the bill that we think would be difficult. I'm not familiar with the specifics of the Illinois and Minnesota bill. But anyway, just to point out that some of our companies who've taken a look at this bill have said, yeesh, that's kind of a lot of detail to be then held for on clawback provisions. If you don't get the start dates right, if you don't get the actual wages right, if you don't get the new employees that you hired from other people right, you're subject to losing or subject to clawback provisions. It's a pretty high hurdle rate with this level of specificity. So that's the only piece I wanted to bring to the debate today, and appreciate the time.
Great. Questions? And for your members, Mr. Kramer, I believe the SIF has been one of probably the main, and that obviously has the natural built-in clawback of got to be $100 million in before you even start to get in the door for the SIF.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, and the SIF is, we think, a very important tool for Oregon, but very limited. I think I have 4 or 5 companies total that have taken advantage of it. So the SIP agreement is out there in Multnomah and Washington counties. It is a limited universe because of the very high hurdle rate of capital investment. And it does have very specific terms and conditions, clawback provisions, community impact fee payments, and the like. So, I'm sure in any analysis that the SIP agreement would survive the light of public scrutiny anticipated in this bill.
Great. Thank you. Okay. Thank you very much. Art, we are up against the clock, but please, and Dale, we're going to try to, if I can keep the committee here, we have a floor session coming up.
Got it.
Mr. Towers.
For the record, my name is Arthur Towers, political director for SCIU Local 503, and all the good testimony has been taken, but there is one point that I do want to add. Well, first of all, I do want to thank the sponsor. Thank you. This is probably the most interesting committee hearing I've been in all session long, and I really applaud the group for struggling with this issue. I think that the one point that hasn't really been zeroed in on in the testimony so far is the issue of confidence in government. And I really think that in the work that y'all have done in other venues too, that that's been an important priority for a number of members of the committee. I think that this sort of legislation to open up the process, to shine a spotlight on how this works, and to get really at the issues that Senator Starr raised, that these things work. I have some skepticism about some of them, but I'm looking forward to the discussion around that. And I think that this legislation can help improve voters and citizens' confidence in the way that state government spends tax dollars. So thank you very much. Thanks for holding this hearing.
You bet. Thank you, Mr. Towers. Questions for Art Towers from SCIU. Thank you. Appreciate the compliment. Second one we've got on the interesting hearings today. So
very good.
Keep coming. We'll try to outdo it.
I'll be a repeat offender, I'm afraid.
that's right, Art. I got something from Nielsen in the mail. Speaking of ratings. Okay, so that's Senate Bill 518. Close the public hearing. Open a public hearing on Senate Bill 69. Ask Dale Penn to bring his panel up. And Mazin will help us introduce the bill. And this might be a quick one.
Can we go to work session?
I'd like to. Dale, I know you may have hammered out an agreement on this. Mazin, do you want to give us a brief overview?
Mr. Chair, I'm afraid that the overview of the bill would be longer than the bill itself.
Just read the bill.
The bill is one line. It says Appeal 461.055. I've included in the SMS that section of the ORS for your convenience in order to be able to know what we're repealing. And it is about the data center backup for the lottery. In Burns, and I believe the discussions that you would be updated on. And
Mr. Penn. Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Dale Penn. I'm director of the Oregon Lottery. I'll quickly try to give you an overview. I don't know of any opposition to this bill. We have Mr. Steve Grasty, who is a county judge from Harney County, here today, and we have Mr. Kenton Dick from the Burns Paiute Tribe, who is also here today. This bill simply assisted in having fiber cable extended out to Burns, Oregon, about 10 years ago. And it did that because the lottery was required to be there and have a backup center, and we needed to have that capability to transmit data. I've also given you a copy of a letter from Lindsey Ball from DAS, which kind of it's a legislative report from last November to an interim committee, but the reason for that letter is it gives a good history of the process and really where all the entities are now, Harney County, DAS, the lottery, Burns Paiute Tribe, and a corporation, Wadaw Corporation. This bill simply removes the requirement of the lottery to have a backup center at Burns. We're at a very time-sensitive time in that we are negotiating a contract with a new gaming provider, which we would be able to do as part of the base contract backup services at the vendor's IT regional location. In effect, we would not have these costs to have a backup center. And that is really the way the industry has gone. This particular vendor has backup sites for four or five other state lotteries in their IT location. So it will save us money. It will give us greater flexibility. It makes sense for the lottery. At the same time, though, there is an independent process going on where the Burns Paiute Tribe, through WADA Corporation, is interested in purchasing this computer center. And so we believe this will work out for everyone as a positive step forward. It's before you simply to remove the requirement from the lottery to have to be located in Burns. We plan to stay there till summer of 08 and transition out by probably January of 09 so that we can provide some stability to the center during that period of time as well. But that's a quick overview. Again, I don't know of opposition. It makes flexibility and dollars and cents wisdom. And with that, I'd be happy to answer questions, and certainly representative from Harney County and representative from the tribe would be happy to speak briefly as well.
Thank you. Thank you for staying with us. We've had a busy schedule again today, but thank you for hanging with us.
Well, let me take it from there, if it's all right, Mr. Chair.
We just need to get your name for the record.
I'm Steve Grasty, Harney County Judge. And greetings from Harney County, and thanks for this opportunity. Also, will tell you that I've been in on several hearings, and this has been an interesting morning, so congratulations for that.
I'll keep a note here. We're like
on a roll.
I want to quickly tell you the story, and I will say it a little differently than Mr. Penn did. The location of the Archive Center finalized the deal to where the route of the fiber optics through Oregon from Seattle to Salt Lake ended up being. And that's a real success story in it. Senator Timms and Hanby had a great idea 10 years ago. It hasn't grown to the economic opportunity that everyone believed it would. I have personally worked on trying to do something entrepreneurial at the center for more than 6 years. I've made dozens of trips across the state. I've spoken to a variety of our state legislatures, to committees, to agency heads. I've watched a constant change of department heads, technology folks, people assigned to the responsibility of trying to do something creative. But as we all know, government isn't the best at being entrepreneurial. And so it's been a real challenge. And with the involvement of the Burns Paiute Tribe and the WADA Corporation, that changed about 3 years ago. And we began to get past some of the regulatory, legal, and financial barriers that have been holding us up. I want to brag on one state employee because sometimes they get missed. Mike Zanin took the lead on this about a year ago and did an incredible job. And when he got assigned to a different responsibility, he didn't let loose of this one and stayed with it. I believe we would not be where we're at today without him. Certainly Mr. Penn and Lindsey Ball are at the table as well. But Mike deserves some real credit for where we've gotten to.
Thank you.
The relationship between tribal government and county government is incredible at home, and it's very positive. It's important to the community, and here's an opportunity for success to a segment of our community that has the highest unemployment rate probably of any group in the state of Oregon. But to make it happen, we need the state to understand that if they walk away from this archive center and go build another one outside the Willamette Valley, they just shut down every opportunity we have. And I want to make sure that gets on the record that I understand the SDC, the State Data Center, and its efforts, and it's doing the right things. It's saving money. It is going the right direction, but it's only 12 state agencies. And if there's archiving to be done in the future, we'd like the opportunity from an entrepreneurial perspective and government-to-government partnership with the tribe to be able to keep that on the table. We need a glide path, and we think we have that where lottery just doesn't walk away tomorrow. We're right there in the conversation with DAS is there as well. So we think we're all right there. The timing's critical on this. The negotiations are underway, and we're almost there. And jobs are everything in that little community we've got out there. Also, one other thing I want on the record. this would not normally qualify for enterprise zone tax exemption. You've been talking about those incentives. Somewhere as this goes ahead, I don't think it fits in this bill, but I'm going to be working. The tribe has had a very positive conversation about paying taxes on this. They understand. Mm-hmm. By the same token, I hope we can get this to qualify for enterprise zone tax abatement for the first 3 years as this comes together. And I'll quit at that.
Thank you, Josh. Appreciate traveling up this morning. Yes, sir.
Good morning, Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Kenton Dick. I'm the president for the Woodout Corporation. I'm also a member of the Burns Paiute Tribe. I've been an employee with the tribe for maybe 28 years, as you can tell from my gray hair. A lot of stress over there occasionally. This started out initially with a RFP by the state, and in working with another organization that was also interested in submitting a bid, we joined forces and submitted a joint RFP from the Burns Paiute Tribe and the Data Storage Information System. We were looking for a contract for a backup for the Burns Archive Center. Software, I believe. We have an intergovernmental agreement initially with the state of Oregon, and then later it moved down to the state agencies, DAS, lottery, and et cetera. So, since November of 2004, since I became on board, we went through countless DAS directors as well as CIOs. I think there's about 4 to 5 different names and faces that I don't even remember who most of them are, except for the last one, which is Mike Zanin, which was very is a good employee that you folks have in regards to supporting this effort and pushing forth along with other staff that you folks have, like Lindsay Ball, Dale Penn here, and in trying to have a working agreement in regards to the hopefully eventual takeover of the Burns Archive Center. A couple issues that Judge Grassley mentioned. We'd like to have employment in Harney County. Harney County or Grant County right north of us has the highest unemployment rate. Burns probably, or Harney County is probably pretty close to that. Current employment in that facility is 2. They maintain the systems for the backup system. And then we're also looking at possibly, if this venture does come forth, possibly hiring a marketing staff as well as a half-time maintenance for the facility itself. A couple concerns that I'd like to maybe express. One is maybe getting assurance to let the state of Oregon be aware that the Burns Archive Center that is still is available for backup services, co-location, and archival services that is still available. I know you have one in Salem, but it also could be another facility that could be used for that same purpose. And then the other is that if we are going to be taking over that facility, and particularly with the archive part of that component, you know, we at least like to get some assurance that maybe another facility in terms of archives be constructed for the next 10 years or so, so that it will give us some time to secure and maybe get contracts with the state of Oregon archives. Mm-hmm. So, but again, thank you very much for your time, and I'll keep it short. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Dick. Questions for this panel?
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Jim.
Close the public hearing on Senate Bill 69. Open a work session on Senate Bill 69.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Starr.
I move the bill to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Starr has moved Senate Bill 69 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion. Any objections to this bill? Support. Senator Starr, do you want to carry the bill? And we will convene tomorrow at 8:45. We're going to look again at this whole university and community college capital construction issue, and we're working on should whether we will amend the bill to set a limit, and it would be obviously guided by the co-chair's number, but we would also engage on that overall GO bond and lottery bond limit, just at the number and certainly not at the project level. Yes, Senator George.
Mr. Chairman, when I heard the number from the co-chairs, I was a little bit shocked based upon what we had done in the committee. Could we have an analysis of what they're planning to do with those other dollars? In other words, I think there's a big difference between what is reasonable and what they're choosing. So I was wondering if we can have an idea of where the rest of the dollars are going to go.
Yeah, and that's going to be the nature of the discussion tomorrow, is to take a look at the number that they have included versus the discussion that we had, and it'll be up to us if we would like to adjust that number and then send the bill to Ways and Means, but we'll be given the opportunity to at least weigh in on it was at the proper level of debt.
Yeah, if we could get a matrix of some kind that demonstrated where the co-chairs allocated the various bonding and how does that fit with really what the governor had requested, I think would be really helpful.
Yeah, we're quickly trying to work. It's obviously 4 or 5 days old, but we're quickly trying to work and get folks lined up for tomorrow, and then we'll probably want to bring the bill back just one more time next week, 5516 and 152, and then if we're going to amend different levels in, and again, we just won't really get into the projects because that's not our jurisdiction at all. And that's what we're trying to line up, Senator Starr and Senator George's good testimony in terms of what the choices that they made and then what choices, was it the proper level or are there other levels that we ought to be considering and kind of the trade-offs that are implicit in that.
And Mr. Senator Chair, Monroe. Senate Bill 6 is coming your way from the Legislative Committee on Reform that met this morning, and it has to do with bonding for the repair and renovation of the wings.
Okay.
So it's coming here first and then to Ways and Means.
Great. Paul, you got all that?
Thank you.
We are adjourned until 8:45 tomorrow, and that's our last meeting for the week.